You're listening to the podcast of the musictherapyresearchblog.com.
Jazz Club.
Hello, listeners. This is Andrew Knight coming to you from Colorado State University. And a little bit about today's episode. I guess you'll call it episode 2 of our reboot of the Music Therapy Research podcast at musictherapyresearchblog.com. So our effort to get a little bit more audio on that site instead of strictly blog posts, synthesis of research and those sorts of things. And today's topic, as a matter of fact, is something that's really integral to the mission of the Music Therapy Research Blog, which is bringing current research to clinicians. One of the big issues that I think a lot of clinicians are interested in is, how do I know what is research-based, and how do I make sure that my practice, the things that I do with clients, participants, consumers, students, whatever your care group is, how do I know that what I'm doing with them is evidence-based and completely ethical and, you know, cutting edge, for lack of a better term? How do I know that what I'm doing is really the thing that I should be doing, especially if you graduated 5 years ago or 10 years ago or 25 years ago? Not to think that things aren't moving and things aren't changing, but certainly our techniques and our protocols and the way that we interact with clients should also be changing over time, especially for our personal and professional growth, and obviously for the best interest of the people that we work with. So the first part of that is, what do you really know about the research process? Not so much about the how do I take research and translate it into practice, which would be for another day, but how do I really know what is a possibility for me as a future researcher or a first-time researcher or whatever you want to label yourself? So Dr. Lagasse and I go into a little bit of some of the explanations for how to first conceptualize research, going through the process, and as always, we think there's a lot of good information from our association, American Music Therapy Association, and one of the parts of the episode, we actually want you to make sure that you go to the AMTA website, musictherapy.org, and check out the Clinician Research Grant, which is actually something that was instituted a couple of years ago by the Research Committee of the AMTA to push clinicians to think a little bit more critically about getting some of the work that they're doing out there into the real world, and using an academician, a professor, somebody with research experience and publication experience, to help formulate those ideas and put them into practice. And certainly something that if you have ideas on research that both Blythe and I are very open to hearing, and she gives a little bit of an example of that in this episode. Again, thanks very much for listening, and we hope you enjoy this episode of the Research Blog podcast. How about we start podcasts like a radio show, like coming at you live from the third floor?
How about we not?
Coming at you live from the third floor of the University Center of the Arts building on the Colorado State University campus. How many people just unsubscribed the podcast just now when they heard that?
Probably all three.
All three people. What do we have to do to get you back? Tweet more often? Do we have to give you answers to exams? Today, talking about research process. Maybe, well, I guess that might even be pigeonholing a little bit, because I think some people think research process and they're thinking about publication, and sometimes people are thinking about research process and they're thinking about, they're just thinking experimentally, and for us, we even talk about what we do on, you know, whether we're talking about having a research day or a research grant or something, and it all starts with ideas and all these other things. I mean, what's the germ of the research process for you?
Really, the ideas, the inquiry, wanting to know how something works or if something can work better than something else. So that drives my process, is the questions that I have in my head that I'd like to answer.
We interviewed Dr. Deborah Burns. What did she say? She said her grandfather or something called her
Just like, but why? Or yeah, something that's like right. that. Yeah. I can't remember.
It was
exactly
always asking a question. Asking it was something, it was like an interrogative question.
Which,
you know, like, how come? Oh, it was how come? That's right.
How come? Yeah.
yeah. Everything's how come? How
I
come
I can actually relate to that because in my history, if you were to interview my parents, they would tell you that I also asked questions. And the general answer was, we'll tell you when you're 16. Well, I realized that that was just a way to not have to answer the plethora of questions I threw at my parents.
Yeah. If we were doing a parenting podcast, like, would the idea would be completely turned around now because it wouldn't be, we'll tell you when you're 16. It's Google it.
Yeah. Google it. Yeah. Just, they didn't have... I'm dating myself. We didn't have Google.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Just Google it.
If you can imagine a time without Google.
It's hard to. It's hard. I was just talking about it the other day, speaking of research process. So starting some of my students off on a basic sort of diagnostic information assignment. You got to learn something about schizophrenia, learn it over the weekend, put together a little presentation, spit it back to us tomorrow, actually, in class. And so there was a librarian, and she was going through your database this and database that. And then we were even going through the citation thing. And I was just looking at all these different ways that you can actually go through just that first part of the, or maybe the second part of the research process, the lit review. I said, everybody over the age of, let's say, like 30 right now hates all of you because you clicked the button and you got the APA citation and it just went into your little database of your citations. And I was thinking, well, who hated me when I had the internet, the first iterations right. of the internet and Google Scholar and everything. And before that, it was people who had, you know, the really nice word processors. And, you know, so there's always some level of technology.
The file cabinet back in the day, you know, you would have to look up an idea in the card catalog and then have it ordered to be able to look at something. And so I think for me, part of the research process is, well, I take for granted that I can have an idea. I can go sit down with my library access from the university. I can look very quickly and get my hands on articles very quickly to see, has someone else looked at this? Do I think that there's any weight behind this idea that I'm thinking of? And then begin starting that process, which is, for me, a lot of reading. So I think of a question, or I get a question in my mind after a session, maybe, and then I'll go and look at what's out there, and that's how I start.
Translating that younger and younger generations is going to be our challenge teaching research methods, both undergrads and then certainly graduate students that need to focus more on research. I was just at the library on the weekend with my kids, and I was trying to show my 8-year-old, this is how you look up a book. And so he was looking for something on birds, and it's pretty basic. You type in birds and that's it, and you know that you're in the kids section. But the hardest part of it for him was I was writing down 987.18775 or something, and then the author's last name and the year that it came out, because I was thinking, well, I'm gonna have to go up and down these this long line of but you know, how much research is really done that way? How much of research is really first of all based on books? People aren't stacking up huge libraries and big shelving systems of books anymore. They're stacking up full access to PDFs, and they're able to go through the AMTA website and go through Oxford University, and they're grabbing those PDFs and they're keeping them. We're all learning this new system about how we're keeping all of our files together, and we're having to think of a new way to database these things so we can remember that. That one article that came out in 2003, what was that important for? And here's the bullet points on that. And if one of those bullet points was important, then I need to go back to it and check out and read more thoroughly or something. It's a completely different system, the way that, you know, our brain is cataloging things, as opposed to the days of, you know, the days of walking around with the laundry baskets full of all of your dissertation reference piles is pretty much gone. Somebody walks into Starbucks with a laundry basket, that's not usually your dissertation student anymore. Right.
No, and I used to have those. I kept files of all the different articles, and now I don't. I do everything online. I do think there's value in some of the books in that there's more of a synthesis of what's out there, whereas a lot of times when you're beginning a research project, it can be really overwhelming looking at all the different research that's out there on a topic. So I'm researching persons who are on the autism spectrum, and the amount of research that you can read is simply overwhelming. And to put it together and figure out, well, what's good research, what's not good research, what is applicable, what do I ignore, that can be really difficult when you're trying to put together a project.
So maybe that's maybe part of that is the actual, maybe it's a marker of the growth of our profession too, that we had the adolescence of our profession where we were just sort of growing up and we didn't really have a lot of information to go off, or the childhood of our adolescent of our profession. We're growing up and we didn't have a lot. So if you just wanted to do a paper on something, it was probably a good chance nobody else had done something on that before. You can find a random syndrome or something. And if you even want to look at the papers that were coming up in JMT, in the Journal of Music Therapy, 60s and 70s and 80s, there were a certain number of them that were one-offs that could have been considered pilot studies, which we'll address in a second. But then there's, so maybe we're in the adolescence. We've got some information now, but now it's a matter of filtering it down a little bit better. So let's start with that then. So your idea process is inquiry. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's step number one is inquiry. What's your line of inquiry? What do you really want to know here? And step number two is what do we know and what do we don't know? It's the lit review. How do you advise people to tackle step two?
Well, I think you said something really important there. What do we know and what do we not yet know? And when I'm writing my lit review, I like to try and be very clear on, you know, here's what we know, here's what's out there, here's the problem, and then here's what this research I hope will begin to answer in some capacity. So when I'm about to write a lit review, I oftentimes will go and read other lit reviews that I find to be really good ones to help guide myself, because, you know, in the days of dissertation thesis writing, you're writing, you know, 50, 60, 70 pages on a topic. And for an article that I someday am going to submit, you're talking 4 to 7 pages. Mm. So to take those two really big questions, what do we know, what do we not know, and boil it down to 4 to 7 pages is extremely difficult to do. So getting a nice model of that and finding a flow from another article that I like, I'll oftentimes model off that when writing my lit review.
This is purely conjecture on my part, but having last one I submitted maybe like a week ago, I found the, and this is publication only, so it's a little bit far afield. It's not too far afield from the research process generally, but the end of the research mm-hmm. process. But I feel like people don't want that much information. Like I said, that might be conjecture on my part, but I feel like there are more journals that are saying that it's not just 4,500 words now, but it's 4,000 mm-hmm. words, or now it's 3,500 words. Yeah. And that includes all your tables and figures and sometimes references, and your abstract is no more than 120 words, where before it was 200 words or 250. And maybe that's just a function of the economics of I want, as an editor, more articles and not use as much paper on them or something. I don't know what it is. Might be conjecture, like I said.
Perhaps, but I've noticed that too, that the literature reviews are getting shorter and shorter in articles, as the abstracts seem to be around that 150 mark. But with that, if I go into a research project thinking, well, I only have to find enough material to fill 4 pages, that's the wrong way to go into it, because I have the chance of missing something. And you have to bet that those peer reviewers are going to find the stuff you missed.
Because they're the experts in that area.
Right, right. So these people are going to be reviewing your article. Even if you're not thinking, oh, publication, you're just thinking, I'd like to do research. It's your responsibility to know where the field stands and where other fields stand on the topic, so that you are using time wisely of the clients that you're bringing in for the research, and that you're directing all of your resources in something that's worthwhile. And to know it's worthwhile, you have to know it's out there.
So let's talk a little bit more specifically about that part of it. So you're a clinician now, and you're interested in research, which is really sort of the mission statement of the Music Therapy Research Blog, mm-hmm. bringing current research to clinicians, mm-hmm. right? So if that's the idea, and the famous conundrum is that the professors are getting paid to do the research, but we don't have the participants, and clinicians have the participants, but they don't have time to do research. Where do you jump into that circle as a clinician who wants to contribute to moving the field forward through research, whether that ends up in a peer-reviewed publication or something at a really high level or not? Where do you jump in?
Well, I'd say, first of all, if you can take any type of a research class, and today with online education, there's a lot of classes you can take or CMTEs on that topic of research so that you have a general idea. But I would reach out to the people doing the research that you see cited in the JMT, MTP, and in other journals outside of our field, and contact them and say, you know, I work at this place and I think that I could recruit participants. Would you be interested in working with me? And in many cases, the answer is going to be, yes, I'd love to partner with you because of that exact problem, that someone might have the research expertise but cannot get the clients. And so you could, as a clinician, help bridge that gap by learning how to do protocol implementation and doing the active data or the active implementation piece of the research project.
Yeah, probably the most important part of collaborative research, which is certainly the direction that research is going, a much more collaborative model than just single author experimental design stuff, is the important part of the collaboration is the desire. And if you've got a bunch of people and you want to know something, that's a really neat connection when people are able to make, I have those questions too. And then if the second person says, I have the same questions as you do, furthermore, I also have these particular dependent measures and I know what the literature looks like a little bit. I'd like to take a little bit of time. I'm going to do this part of it and figure out if those measures are the right ones, if that survey instrument is what we're supposed to use, or if these clinical measures are what we're supposed to be using. Why don't you start on your side of things and move towards like the IRB process, look into that for your institution. Let's figure, you know, starting that division of labor into the collaborative process. And that's a big, you know, just to plug the AMTA clinician grant. That's the idea of what the research committee is trying to do, is that
exactly.
They want to move people forward. And that the notion of that grant is that the clinician is the germ of the idea, in that they're moving forward and it's guided by somebody who's got the research experience in the first place.
Mm-hmm. And who has an IRB, likely. If you're at a university, you have an IRB you could run a project through as a collaborative project. And that actually just happened to me the other day, not with the grant, but I had a clinician contact me from the Seattle area and say, I'm really interested in researching this. You have done work in this area. Would you be willing to collaborate with me? And it's something that falls in the line of things that I'd like to research. And I said, absolutely. So we already have a project started as of this week with the initial phases of collecting information and getting together a protocol. And I think that's potentially one of the most difficult things as a clinician to do in research, is following a protocol. Because in most research designs, we want some type of protocol that you can replicate and you can explain clearly to others who are reading your research. And it's a different mindset than being a clinician, where you do whatever you've got to do. And so as a clinician myself, that's something that I also struggle with, is my clinician instinct is to do this. But as a part of this particular research protocol, here are my options that I can do in this instance with this issue that might come up with a client in the research situation or in the protocol that we're doing.
Mm. And that might be one of the more misunderstood aspects of research methodology. People could be thinking, well, that sounds like a very quantitative thing. You just said protocol,
mm-hmm.
and you just said that this is, you know, you got to do the exact same thing every time. But you didn't really say that.
No.
It's whether it's quantitative or qualitative, or even if it's historical, and the methodological component of any research process is paramount. It's when I look at papers that I'm reviewing for a journal, I don't go to the lit review first. I want to see the methods section, and I want to see how sound that methods section is first, to see if any findings could be valid in the first place. The methodology is really important, but then again, it's also where we run into more of our barriers. So, money. What are some of the barriers, funding, that you find that most people run into, grants, that seem to be an issue for clinicians? Money, time, as opposed to people that just sort of want to do little studies or just keep data on the clinical work that they're already doing.
Right.
Funding.
Well, I think you're bringing up two different things there. We have the issue with money that you have been slipping in there, and
I did that in post production. You didn't hear me do that. Yeah, those are all going to be whispers. I'm going to do it like the Jim Morrison track on Doors recordings, where you just hear it as a separate track.
Interesting. Well, there is money issue, because with a lot of the designs that I've worked with, we want some type of testing measure before and after. So although you as a clinician can do the protocol, so you might be able to implement a certain music therapy technique or set of techniques for the population that you're working with, we oftentimes look for someone else to do the pre and post test measure. And right there, you need money to pay someone to do that. So money is obviously a really big issue.
You mean I can't do it? You mean I can't do the pre and post?
Well, it depends on what the pre and post is. Is it within your scope of practice? Are you trained in it? For instance, I'm interested in communication, as I know you are as well, Dr. Knight. And a lot of the assessments for communication are outside of our scope of practice. We do not have the training to look at communication assessments. You really need a speech-language pathologist for that. So either you have to have a very friendly speech path who believes in what you're doing, or you have to pay someone to do those pre and post-test assessments. And depending on what it is you're looking at, that can begin to get very costly. You also often will want some type of assessment to say, where are your clients at the beginning? So I work with children with autism spectrum disorder, and the current most used assessment to say where they are as far as their different skills and abilities is the ADOS, the Autism Diagnostic Observation Scale, which in my state costs about $800 per time it's administered. Well, if I want a small study, let's say with 15 people, and I need to use that as a pre and a post, already you can see that we have a lot of financial commitment that's needed in order to make that happen.
So you either have to take donuts over to the Communication Science and Disorders Department once a week.
Which is a great strategy. That can actually work. But maybe go a little health conscious. Apples, you know?
health conscious. Looking at where those opportunities are. For me, when I was starting, it was, I wasn't looking at external grant opportunities. When I say external, I'm usually talking in the academic sense. We talk about internal, external, or even in terms of a business, you know, there's internal grant opportunities, things that the business or the university provides, and then there's external, which are federal grants usually. But start even more local than that. I was successful getting a couple little grants for a couple $100s, a couple $1,000s here and there, that just provided, one of them provided for some instruments, one of them provided for some outcome measures, and that's sort of how you just start with that, and that gets you on the road to a pilot study where you can get some good data. Now, you wrote the latest, you know, feature article, Journal of Music Therapy, that was specific to pilot studies. Mm-hmm. How do you want, would you recommend that when somebody is talking about research process, would you say to them, pilot study is the starting point to that? That you shouldn't be thinking about going too big or just try to latch on to like a 7-person team or somebody else already doing something?
Right. Well, on the one hand, I think latching on or collaborating with others.
I mean collaborating. Collaborating.
Is a great way to learn the process of research. So if you do have the possibility of working on a research team, once I started working with other researchers that were more experienced than I, and the current team I'm working on are people who are in occupational therapy, I have learned so much about the research process that I just wasn't seeing before because they're more experienced. They've been around the block a couple of times, as we like to say. As far as piloting, I think piloting is actually a responsibility of the researcher. Even if I have this really grand, big idea that I'd like to do, unless I do it on a smaller scale to make sure that the measures I'm using are good measures, that the data is going in the direction I would expect it to go in, and so forth, I could be putting a lot of resources towards something that might not work. And so it gives me the chance to work out the kinks before I put all of those resources. And I'm not just talking about money. I'm talking about time of mine, the research team, and the participants to do this project. So you could say it's a responsibility, even an ethical responsibility, to make sure that the idea and the way that you're going to conduct the research is the best way you could do it before putting forth all of those resources.
Mm-hmm. Like a good children's book asking, so what did we learn today, kids? Just talking very broadly, this podcast being a broad overview of the research process, it starts with inquiry. It starts with how come this, how come that? It starts with what else do you want to know about something? And that's not a music therapy thing. That is a research thing more generally. And those, what those actual questions look like are probably things that are going to dictate the process that you go through to start it from there. Then it's a matter a little bit of literature review, finding out what exists, what do we know, and what don't we know. There's also the question of collaboration. There's the question of who can you meet up with. Should you meet up with somebody else in your field who maybe has some more access to the IRB, the Institutional Review Board, if we didn't define that earlier, and figuring out how you make this whole thing happen ethically and safe for everybody involved and productively. And then there's a matter of that IRB also asking, so what are your methods? And that's something else you have to think about ahead of time. Mm-hmm. What are the things that I'm going to do, and how am I going to know if what I did really mattered and made a difference? Whether that's, but that's not a methodological question in terms of is it quantitative or qualitative or anything. It's what's the protocol? What's the thing that I'm going to do over and over again to figure out how I'm going to solve my own riddle, the riddle that I came up with, which is how come, and I'm not quite sure about this. Any last bits of advice? What's the one bit of advice that you give to students, even all the way through somebody who might have been in the field for like 20 years and now they're thinking, this is something I'd really like to get into now?
I think a lot of, excuse me, when we think about research, I think a lot of times we think about randomized control trial, big study. And one of the things that I tell students or other new researchers, because I consider myself a new researcher as well.
An excited new researcher, according to your Twitter bio.
Yes, researcher. Something that I really like to point you towards is single system design and learning about methods that are not randomized controlled trial, because they're extremely valuable and they're more feasible within a clinical situation than a lot of times the randomized controlled trial is going to be. So broaden your idea of what is research and learn about those other methodologies that can be really, really beneficial to the field.
That'll wrap it up for episode 2 of Music Therapy Research Podcast. We'll see you back here on musictherapyresearchblog.com for all the rest of the podcast and other posts on topics that are important to you in the field of music therapy. Thanks for listening.
Music for today's podcast is Jazz Club by Chris. This has been the Music Therapy Research Podcast associated with musictherapyresearchblog.com. Your hosts are Dr. Blythe Lagasse and Dr. Andrew Knight, music therapy faculty members at Colorado State University. Follow MTRB on Facebook and your hosts on Twitter to stay up on all the music therapy research we send out into the world. If you enjoyed the podcast, please let us know by heading to iTunes and submitting a review and a rating. It only takes a minute and helps our visibility on the iTunes page tremendously. Thanks in advance. Also, send in a comment about the podcast on the contact page at musictherapyresearchblog.com.
Lester Young.